I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American empire, national security state operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, the Iranian elections are coming up on June 18th, and recent leaked material indicates that there has been a power shift to hardliners in the region. Joining us to discuss that, as well as the broader story of the JCPOA, otherwise known as the Iran deal, the history of U.S.-Iranian relations, and the Iran nuclear program, is journalist Gareth Porter, whose work can be read at The Gray Zone, Consortium News, and, of course, antiwar.com. His latest article is entitled Leak Reveals Power Shifting to Hardliners in Iran, and is the basis for much of our conversation. So, with all that being said, let's get right to it with Gareth Porter. Welcome to Parallax Views, a guest that I've been wanting to have on for some time now, journalist Gareth Porter, who writes for a number of publications, The Gray Zone, Consortium News, and antiwar.com, among others. How are you doing today, Gareth?
I'm fine, thanks. Glad to be on.
So I wanted to have you on my program, Parallax Views, to discuss one of your recent articles, Leak Reveals Power Shifting to Hardliners in Iran. But first, maybe you can give my listeners a little bit of background on your history of journalism relating to U.S. foreign policy, national security, and particularly those two things in relation to Iran. You've even written a book co-authored with John Kiriakou.
Yeah, well, I'll try to limit the scope of this answer as best I can, although I've been doing this now for over 15 years, and my interest as a journalist in writing about national security policy of the United States is in some ways it's a result of my previous history as a scholar and activist that began, of course, with Vietnam War. When I was young enough to be of draft age, as they say, that powerfully concentrates the mind. And I began to look in very seriously to the nature of this conflict in Vietnam that the United States was being drawn into, even when I was an undergraduate in college. And had ideas of being a journalist at that point. I began to, look at Vietnam, and my life was clearly reshaped by the nature of this war and its reach into American society. I did not go as a soldier, but I did end up living in Vietnam for a year as a scholar doing my doctoral dissertation at Cornell University. In 1971, my research in 1971, and also serving as the bureau chief for Dispatch News Service International during that year and writing regularly for them. So my interest in national security journalism really goes back to much longer time ago during the Vietnam War. I'll skip the rest of that story, but just come to the second round, which was the Iraq War, when I was just finishing a book on how the United States got into Vietnam for University of California Press in 2004. Of course, the United States invaded Iraq, and that was my cue to start thinking in terms of writing about another war. And that's what I did starting in late 2004, 2005. And ever since then, I've written for various publications, beginning with Interpress Service, focusing on whatever the current U.S. war or threatened war happened to be. And so I've written about Afghanistan. I've spent a couple of trips to Afghanistan investigating that situation, and went to Pakistan when the tensions between the U.S. and Pakistan were high. I wrote about Syria, of course, but I did not visit there. And of course, I spent a lot of time writing about the Iraq War up until the exodus of U.S. troops. So that has been my interest for the past roughly 15 years, a little bit more than that now. And I am now working on a book which tries to present what I think are my central insights into the nature of U.S. national security policy from the beginning of the Cold War to the present, with an emphasis on the history of the Cold War as reinterpreted in light of what I believe is the primary dynamic at work, which is the vested interests, the institutional interests of the military services in particular, the three major military services, the Army, Navy, and Air Force, and the Pentagon, civilian Pentagon secondarily, as well as the CIA, State Department, and other agencies that have become involved. And I think it's those interests that have driven the policy of the United States from the beginning more than any other single factor. So that's what I'm going to try to document in a very detailed way by sort of reinterpreting the history of the Cold War through that lens.
With regards to Iran, why has there been so much just issues between the U.S. and Iran? And why have we not gotten back into the JCPOA?
Well, those are two very, very big questions and important questions for Americans to really ponder. I agree completely. In addition to the book that I did with John Kiriakou a couple of years ago now, I also published a book in 2014 called Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare, which does in fact present a kind of history of the whole issue of how the United States has interacted with Iran about the question of its nuclear program from the very beginning of that program back in the early 1980s. And of course, it existed under the Shah as well, but it was reinstated by the Islamic Republic of Iran in the early 1980s, 1981-82. And what I point out in that book is that it really all started when the Reagan administration was supporting Iraq in its war against Iran. Of course, the Iraqi government under Saddam invaded Iran stayed in that war with Iran for the next 7 or 8 years. And during that period, the United States government was, you know, behind Iraq all the way, providing arms, if not directly, at least through its good offices with Europeans to encourage them to supply arms to Iraq, and as well providing intelligence to the Iraqi government and basically knowing that they were using chemical weapons, which is something that I think Americans don't generally understand, just how complicit the United States government was under the Reagan administration in the use of chemical weapons that killed tens of thousands and injured more than 100,000 Iranians during that war. So that was really the beginning of this conflict. And there was no good reason for the United States to act against the Iranian nuclear program. They simply were punishing Iran as the country that they wanted to lose that war. They were trying to do whatever they could against Iran. And that was one of the things they thought of. I had an interview with the then National Security Council official who was in charge of the Middle East. And he confirmed that they really didn't have any strong reason for doing so, that it was just one of those things that they thought of that they could do against Iran. And it kind of continued to sort of spiral out of control ever since then, because ever since then, there have been more and more reasons that various U.S. administrations have discovered for punishing Iran because of its nuclear program. And of course, a major part of it was the U.S. alliance with Israel. It was the Clinton administration, really, that made that a major reason for its opposition to the Iranian nuclear program, picking up the Israeli notion that the Iranians wanted to have nuclear weapons in order to threaten Israel as an existential threat to Israel, which, of course, was absolutely untrue. I mean, there was no evidence whatever that Iran had any such thing in mind, and or that they even were thinking about nuclear weapons in their nuclear program. They had a nuclear reactor left over from the Shah, which the Europeans, the Germans, and the French had agreed to help them restore. And the Iranians were going to provide, they weren't going to make their own nuclear fuel. They weren't going to enrich uranium to do that. They were going to rely on a consortium in Europe to provide the nuclear fuel. So they obviously had no intention of going for nuclear weapons. But this was the determination of politically of the United States to accuse them of doing so. And it has spiraled, as I say, out of control ever since then, with more and more layers of mythology built on top of the original myth that they were interested in acquiring nuclear weapons. And I describe in my book an Israeli plot, essentially, to create a set of documents, to fabricate a set of documents that were introduced through the Mujahideen-e Khalq, this Iranian exile group that had fought with Saddam against Iran. They had committed terrorist actions against the Iranian government before they were forced out of the country. And then they picked up with the Israelis, and the Israelis used them to distribute or to bring these documents, which were fabricated to show that Iran had a covert nuclear weapons research program, and got into the hands of German intelligence, which then gave it to the CIA. And that was really when the story began to become very dark indeed. And I describe in detail that whole episode and the importance that it played in convincing the United States government and then the rest of the world that Iran was indeed guilty of having had a covert nuclear weapons program. It was all a myth propagated cleverly by the Israeli government.
In regards to these leaks, I guess yes. We'll have to get into Iranian Foreign Minister Zarif and his remarks that came out of these leaks. For my listeners, what exactly is revealed in these leaks?
Well, the context here is that Mohammad Javad Zarif, longtime foreign minister of Iran, a very well-educated in the United States, got his law degree in the United States, and very articulate and a very strong opponent of nuclear weapons, who essentially crafted the pragmatic argument, which had been used by the Iranian government in the 1990s and 2000s against having nuclear weapons, which was that they didn't need them. They were perfectly capable of deterring the Israelis or any other potential aggressor, including the United States, without nuclear weapons. So that's what he is known for within the context of Iranian foreign policy. And he was giving a very, very long series of interviews for an historical archive of some sort, not very well defined exactly what the purpose of it was, but that was the idea. It was not for publication. It was for something that would be held for the purpose of the Iranian government itself, for a history of his experience as foreign minister, I believe, was the purpose. So in the context of that set of interviews, Zarif was quoted as saying some things that were leaked by somebody. Nobody has yet determined or been able to identify who leaked this, but it was leaked to an anti-Iran publication or media outfit in the Arab Middle East, UAE. And so it was clearly not done by someone close to Zarif or anyone in the Iranian government itself. Somehow or other, it leaked out to the enemies of Iran. In these interviews, he revealed a number of incidents that he had been very upset about as foreign minister for understandable reasons. For one thing, he talked about the fact that the head of the, or rather the former head, now martyred Soleimani, General Soleimani of the Revolutionary Guard Quds Force, had used the JCPOA, the nuclear deal, once it was finished and had been approved by all the parties. He used the fact that Iran was then able to use its national carrier, Iran Air, freely. He used that to carry weapons and military personnel to Syria from Iran. And although Javad Zarif would have had nothing against, in principle, having those weapons and personnel go to Syria, he was upset because he was not even informed that this was happening. And of course, the consequences for Iranian foreign policy of it becoming public would have been very serious. So that was the first thing he mentioned. Then he talked about the fact that when President Assad of Syria visited Tehran in 2019, again, as foreign minister, he was not even informed that it was happening until the day that he arrived, until Assad arrived. He was unaware that it was happening. And this was, again, all managed by Soleimani as head of the Quds Force, who was, in effect, becoming the de facto foreign minister of Iran, at least with regard to those countries where he had been clearly the man who was making key decisions in relation to those contacts that they were having, that the IRGC was having with both Assad in Syria and with the with Iran's friends in Iraq as well. So that was the context for Javad Zarif to be upset about a number of events that had occurred, which were illustrative of the degree to which he was no longer able to have anything to say about relations with neighboring countries in the Middle East, essentially.
So just a few things I want to note here. These are sort of revealing conflicts that he had with Soleimani. I want to get into that a little bit more, the effect of General Soleimani's murder, essentially.
Yes.
But first, if we could, you said we don't know who exactly leaked this, but I think it's interesting who it was leaked to. It was leaked to an anti-Iran, pro-Saudi television outlet in London, correct?
I thought it was, I guess it is London. You're right. It's owned by an Arab outfit, but it was located physically in London. You're right.
So in regards to the assassination of General Soleimani, what effect do you think this has had on how Iran and Iranians look at the United States, and has this also led to a shift when it comes to hardliners?
Well, look, there's no doubt that the assassination of Soleimani was a very big event in terms of provoking anger among Iranians by and large. This was, as I'm sure many of your listeners are very well aware, an event that provoked an unprecedented outpouring of Iranians into the streets to mourn the passing of this hero of Iran's activities in and relations with both Iraq and Syria. And so he was extremely revered, no question about that. But I would want to put that specific event and its significance in a broader context of Soleimani's role over a period of years, particularly since 2013-2014, both in Iraq and in Syria. But you know, beginning with let's begin with Iraq, because that was the initial set of events, the sequence of events in which Soleimani played such a key role. And it's very important for your listeners to know that the situation in Iraq in 2014-2015 was one where ISIS suddenly was springing to life and threatening to gain such a enormous amount of territory in Iraq that they actually constituted a serious threat to the Iraqi government. They had already seized one third of the entire territory, and they were on the move. They were taking the offensive, and the Iraqi army, which the United States had the primary role in assisting and advising at that point, was proved unable to do anything effectively to stop them. And so there was a huge, a real catastrophe in the making here, a crisis that created a great deal of fear on the part of Iraqis about the future of their country. And it was in that situation that Soleimani stepped in. Of course, it was also Sistani, the Shiite leader, a church leader, who had played an important role in giving an edict that called for the formation of militias, both Shiite and Sunni, to resist the onslaught of the ISIS people. And so that did happen. They were formed very quickly as an emergency matter. But it was Soleimani who then came in and took leadership over the defense of Iraq against ISIS using the PMA, militia units that had been formed, people's militias that had been formed specifically for that purpose. And his leadership was so effective that he is credited by virtually everyone in Iraq with having saved the country. And so, you know, in terms of that heroism, it was, of course, then relayed back to Iran, and everyone in Iran recognized that, they had somebody in Soleimani who had been able to prevent ISIS from potentially taking over Iraq. So that was the first of these major heroics that Soleimani had performed. The second one, of course, was Syria, where it was not so much ISIS, although they played a big role in Syria as a threat. But in 2015, it was Al-Qaeda's offshoot that was threatening to position itself where it could bid for power nationally. It could threaten the Syrian government. So it was at that point that the IRGC moved in and played a huge role in as an ally of the militias that were formed there in Syria, as well as the government, and militias that came from outside of Syria to form a blocking force, a totality of forces that turned back, that helped to turn back the threat from Al-Qaeda in Syria. And along with the Russians, of course, they came in 2015 as well. And that was regarded by everyone in Iran as having made the difference in Syria between a potential takeover by anti-Shiite, bloodthirsty Al-Qaeda and ISIS people. And again, it was Soleimani who was credited with that victory over the bad guys. And so it's that background that you have here that formed the basis for a totally new view of Soleimani over this period from 2014 through 2020, when he was assassinated, as a hero unprecedented in the history of Iran. And you know, I think that this is really the most important thing to understand about the role that Soleimani has played in Iranian politics, because there was a huge shift in Iranian public opinion towards the basically viewing the IRGC, Quds Force, and the IRGC in general in a much more favorable way. There was a lot of criticism of the IRGC's role in Iran because of the economic role that they've played in the past, and the knowledge that many of these former IRGC generals you know, had cushy jobs and positions because of that. But the heroism of Soleimani in both Syria and in Iraq, I think, has clearly shifted the balance of public opinion much more dramatically toward supporting strongly the role of the IRGC. And that has been accompanied, of course, you know, it's paralleling another track, which has been the collapse of the JCPOA because of the Trump administration and the fact that the U.S. government has refused to do anything when, you know, you had a new administration coming in under Biden to reverse that, although supposedly they're talking about this and we can have a further conversation about it. But at least thus far, the United States government has done nothing to reverse Trump's trashing of the JCPOA. And the result is that everyone, well, not everyone, but two-thirds of the public in Iran are known to have a very strong opinion that the time for negotiating with the United States has ended. And they do not have any faith in the JCPOA anymore.
I want to add to that really quickly, if I could. I think the other thing here is, you know, I think if you're an Iranian, you look at the idea of reducing IRGC activities in the region, and you're just going to think, as you put it in the article, the United States would only make further demands on Iran. If you're an Iranian, I think that would be your thinking at this point.
Well, that's right. And I, you know, I would think that that's probably the case. if the Iranians made some sort of concessions on the role of the IRGC, which I don't think is going to happen, you know, I think the United States would probably see Iran as weakened, and as the U.S. government does when it sees an advantage, a power advantage increasing, it becomes tougher. I mean, I can tell you that is the history of the U.S. government from the Cold War down to the present. So I think that's a very accurate statement.
Just a few more things I briefly want to cover here. With regards to President Obama, what was the significance of the JCPOA? And it seems like one of his, you know, better accomplishments. What do you think the significance of the original Iran deal was? And, you know, I guess second to that is, why was it dismantled by the sort of Trump regime?
Ah, yes. Well, two very different storylines, right? But they do meet in a way. They do connect, obviously. The question of the Obama administration's negotiation of the JCPOA is a very interesting one. And, you know, there is a kind of hidden history of these negotiations on the American side, which I've written about, but very few people are aware of. And that is that, of course, from the Iranian point of view, they never had the intention of going for nuclear weapons, but the Americans were accusing them of this, and they were insisting that in order to get back their full rights internationally, in other words, to have the extreme sort of load of sanctions against the Iranian economy lifted, they would have to agree to a very stringent regime that guaranteed against nuclear weapons. Well, you know, in a way, it was like the rabbit who said, please don't throw me in the briar patch, because the Iranians, of course, were happy to have an agreement which would result in lifting the sanctions. At least that was the formal purpose of it. And they were willing to give up, you know, to make major concessions on their nuclear program in order to have that done. And indeed, I make the argument in my book very strongly that one of the key interests that was being served by Iran's original nuclear program was not simply power, because they could never get sufficient nuclear material or you know, the material they needed to fuel enough reactors to power much of anything in Tehran or anywhere else, but it was to actually be able to get the rest of the world, get the United States, I should say, to back off its sanctions, which began very heavily under the Clinton administration. So it was a bargain. It was a set of bargaining chips and bargaining leverage for the Iranian government from the beginning. That's the way they quite clearly recognized it. And so during these negotiations, you can see the Iranians very carefully calculating how best to use their negotiating position, their negotiating chips, in terms of these negotiations with the Obama administration to maximize the effect on the final result. And so what they did was that they built up a huge capability in their enrichment facilities to actually enrich uranium at 20%, such a capability that they would be very close to having the enrichment capability to actually have a nuclear weapon if they had gone ahead and completed the enrichment that was threatened by the deployments of equipment that they had already made. But they had never intended to do that. It was all a bargaining ploy. And they were conveying to the Obama administration that we could do this if we wanted to, but what we really want is this agreement to be effective in lifting the sanctions. And the Obama administration officials got that message. They did understand it, as I've written in a couple or three articles in the past. So it's very important to understand the role of uranium enrichment for Iran as a piece of bargaining leverage and bargaining chips.
You know, the other interesting aspect of this before we wrap up, and you mentioned this in the article, there is this tension between Shia religious principles and the IRGC's focus on Iran's military requirements. For people that are unfamiliar with that tension, could you maybe draw that out a little bit?
Yes, absolutely right. Thanks very much for bringing that up, because it is a very key part of the story of Iran's foreign policy that very few people are aware of. My knowledge of this goes back to several years, to an interview that I did with the wartime. When I say wartime, I mean the Iran-Iraq wartime minister of military supply for the IRGC forces, who were, of course, the Iranian army at that point, the only Iranian army that existed. He explained to me that when he had got the job originally, and the Iraqis were carrying out chemical weapons attacks against Iranian forces, he thought that it would make sense for Iran to try to have its own chemical weapons capability and to retaliate, or at least threaten to retaliate, against the Iraqis in order to get them to stop. And so he went to Ayatollah Khomeini, then the supreme leader of Iran and the founder of the Iranian Republic. He went to him and pleaded for him to approve the program that he had visualized and begun to put into practice, although he hadn't done anything physically to produce anything. And by the way, he included in his proposal not only chemical weapons, but also nuclear weapons as well. And so he was hoping to get the Ayatollah to basically approve a variety of weapons of mass destruction. And instead, the Ayatollah told him, absolutely not. This is forbidden under Islam. You will dismantle all of the program. Anything that you've done will be dismantled. And as for anybody who is an expert on nuclear affairs, they should be sent to the civilian nuclear program instead of anything having to do with weapons. So he didn't do anything about this. But then later in the war, he told me that by the late in the war, the Iraqis were actually attacking civilian populations in Iran with chemical weapons, and civilians were suffering severe death and injury. And so we went back to the Ayatollah and asked him again about doing something about chemical weapons. And at that point, he actually had done some preliminary work to acquire the necessary chemicals to have chemical weapons. But again, the Ayatollah said, absolutely not. You will end this immediately. We may not possess weapons of mass destruction of any kind. So that was the background. And what it shows is that the IRGC was interested in, more effective military capabilities against their potential foes or actual foes. That's their main concern. And this came up again, as I point out in my article, in the 1990s, when the Iranians were in the process of beginning to build an enrichment facility for their nuclear program, nuclear enrichment program. And the IRGC specialists on nuclear, or people who knew nuclear, believe that now it would make sense to at least acquire the knowledge of how to make nuclear weapons. Not that they would go ahead and do it, but that this would make sense to have the knowledge. And so there was some work being done. Now, no one knows what that work was, but I'm quite convinced that it was not anything more than something that was done within their offices, unlike what was purveyed to the U.S. public and the world by these Israeli documents, which I pointed out were fake. But in any case, these were projects that were not approved by the Iranian government. And by 2003, the word had gotten around that something was going on. And the then supreme leader, Khamenei, forbade any such work very explicitly, and threatened to have these people, accused of violating Islam, being guilty of violating Islam. And it did stop. Everybody agrees that it did stop, whatever they were doing. And so there is, as you suggest, this tension between the IRGC's interest in weapons of mass destruction when they felt that it was necessary, and the Islamic law that the supreme leader holds to be the primary arbiter of all laws and policies. And he's the one who makes that decision. So I'm suggesting that there's likely to be future tension over issues relating to the nuclear issue. If the JCPOA is not brought back to life very quickly and the sanctions lifted, which I'm sorry to say, I don't think is very likely.
That's something I wanted to touch on here. The elections in Iran are, I believe, on June 18th. What is it looking like right now? When we say hardliners, that there's been a power shift towards them, what do we mean by that for people that may be unfamiliar?
Well, I think it means two things. One, that public opinion in Iran clearly has shifted very decisively against the policies of the Rouhani government, which relied on reaching agreement with the United States and really essentially did not give that much attention to the need to oppose the United States and its allies through other means. And I think public opinion is much more favorable to the IRGC view, which takes a very dim view of the JCPOA and is inclined to feel that it's going to be necessary to take a much stronger stand against the United States across the board in the region. And the second thing is, I think that any candidate that is seen as supporting the JCPOA is likely to suffer, and candidates that are critical of the JCPOA are likely to gain. And overall, you know, it's clear that candidates of the right are in a better position to win the election than candidates who represent in any way, shape, or form the pragmatist viewpoint of the Rouhani government. Now, whether there's anybody who's actually going to represent that viewpoint clearly is another question. I don't think it is going to be very well represented in the very short run-up to the election. I suspect that the candidates are going to steer clear of that, knowing that what public opinion is. So I think that's really that's the main result here, that the candidates that are running are going to be running on a platform, variations on the theme of saying that we distrust the JCPOA, it's time to have our own independent policy and to guard our own interests here and not rely on the United States.
And what does that mean for U.S.-Iran relations going forward? I guess the million-dollar question is for Americans. How will this affect us? What could the negative consequences be?
Well, I think that, again, barring an agreement right now in the coming weeks, the next couple of weeks, let's say, between Iran and the United States to restore the JCPOA and to make unprecedented U.S. concessions, very clear-cut concessions to Iran to get rid of the most obnoxious sanctions against Iran, then I think the consequences will be that Iran is going to be taking a much harder line in all its contacts with the United States and with Europeans on issues that relate to the nuclear issue, as well as other issues. You know, I don't want to overdramatize this, but I think there will be a discernible shift in the foreign policy line, and it will go beyond what you had when Ahmadinejad was president of Iran. Ahmadinejad was really not as radical as he was made out to be by his critics in the West, in the United States in particular, and of course in Israel. And I think that we're likely to see a candidate emerge who will at least be elected on a campaign that emphasizes a much stronger position than Ahmadinejad took. We'll have to wait and see, but that's my gut feeling.
One more question here. I promise to let you go after this because I know I kept you a little bit over time. I guess the one thing that keeps coming up for me when thinking about the U.S. and Iran and the relations between the two countries, you know, it seems like there's potential and there long has been one, for diplomacy between the two countries. I mean, Iran is a Shia country. I think they feel threatened by sort of Wahhabist and Salafist jihadism in the same way we claim to be. We have some shared enemies. I think we can work some things out. And I guess for me, am I misinterpreting that? It just seems like we've taken a really insane approach to Iran, and I don't understand it. It doesn't make sense to me.
Well, you're absolutely right that logically the United States and Iran should have been able to not only get along, but to work out some arrangements which would be to the benefit of both sides. And indeed, you may recall back in 2003, there was a diplomatic proposal that was sent to the Bush administration by Iran, which laid out a kind of a process, if you will, for trying to reach such a broad bargain, a grand bargain, if you will, between Iran and the United States. And it would include all of the major issues: Israel, nuclear issue, the region, and so forth. And that was simply a reflection of the fact that the Iranian government at that point was very sympathetic to the idea of using diplomacy, just as you described it, to work out a new relationship with the United States. From their point of view, it was particularly a favorable time to reach such an agreement. And of course, as I'm sure many of your listeners will recall, the Bush administration simply refused to even pay any attention to it, pretended as though nothing had actually happened, ignored it, and even punished the Swiss intermediary for having passed it on. And that was, in a way, kind of indicative of a broader cast of mind of U.S. administrations, particularly Republican administrations, that was exactly the opposite of the Iranian viewpoint, which is that we have no interest whatever in diplomacy with Iran, because they either wanted regime change in Iran, as the Bush administration, you know, clearly was flirting with, the George W. Bush administration, or they were very so close to the Israeli point of view that to have any notion of working out a deal with Iran was strictly verboten. And so I think it's either an extreme sort of right-wing neoconservative view during the Republican administrations allied with Syria, with Israel, or it was a Democratic administration which was following the sort of traditional view that we want to support Israeli policy, and therefore giving the Israelis a kind of veto over any friendly relations with Iran. I think that generally explains the pattern of U.S. policy, which was to essentially renounce what would have been the sensible thing to do.
And I was just going to add to that. A lot of people will try to talk about Iranian domestic politics, and people bring up issues like human rights. But I mean, regardless of what you think is going on politically in Iran, the things we've done, such as these sanctions, I mean, it doesn't help Iranian civilians. I mean, these sanctions are brutal. And, you know, I just consider the whole thing very sad all around.
Well, I couldn't agree with you anymore that this sanctions policy is totally brutal towards the very people who supposedly we care about as Americans. And I would just point out, however, that the person in the Trump administration who was in charge of sanctions openly declared that essentially the people of Iran didn't matter. They would have to pay the price for the continuation of Iranian policy if they wanted the Iranians to stop their policy and therefore have a change in the sanctions policy. It was up to them to get a new government.
It was punishing them for not voting the way we wanted them to.
Exactly.
Well, Gareth Porter, I want to thank you for coming on Parallax Views. Hopefully we can have you on again in the future, maybe after the elections. How can my listeners read your work?
Well, I think the best way is Gray Zone, because I have a regular gig with them. I'm writing regularly for them. And that would be, for the time being at least, the best place to look for me.
And thank you again, Gareth Porter, for coming on Parallax Views.
Thanks so much for having me. I enjoyed it.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with journalist Gareth Porter. Be sure to keep up with his work if you found our conversation enlightening. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@ProtonMail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Chase, Zach, Omar, Ted, Brian, Gratz, Martin, Gary, Amelia, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There is also a $1 tier and a $5 tier. Any amount will help. Your support is what keeps this show going. So if you appreciate the work I do, $1, $5, $10, $15, doesn't matter. Please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Again, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.